Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome, Natasha Mitchell joining you for All in the Mind, and with the first of two shows exploring new science and difficult ethics, mind reading. Of course, very little in our computer-dominated world feels private. Our banking details, the websites we visit, all monitored. We're watched over by street cameras. Even the keystrokes we type can be recovered and read. Possibly the only truly private space is your mind. But even that may be about to be compromised. Today, neuroscience in the witness stand. The US courthouse in Phoenix, Arizona, recently hosted a conference on the law and ethics of brain scanning, the next big thing coming to a courthouse near you.
And that's why we are here today, to learn and apply the reasoning and the information that we learn to these advances and to help us in the future to move forward. Well, let's get this show on the road. Thank you.
U.S. District Court Judge Rosalind Silver launching the event, attended by fellow judges, psychologists, neuroscientists, lawyers and ethicists. A motley crew, you might think. Pauline Newman was there for All in the Mind.
Neuroscience has caught the attention of the law. And as you'll hear today, some predict brain scans will become commonplace in the courts in the effort to help convict offenders or to free them. But can we really biologically categorise people as dangerous, impulsive, untrustworthy, even criminal? The extent to which our genes and biology drive our behaviours and beliefs has become a hot potato in the legal arena. Where does it leave questions of privacy, free will, and personal responsibility?
The ability for people to freely do and don't do things, I think it's pretty much restricted. I think it's brain-driven, but beyond that, I think it's much more restricted than society at large might think.
There's databases of people's brain data. Could somebody go back later and find out personality aspects and predilections that people might really want to remain private? This information has to be very carefully guarded.
It just opens up a can of worms of really difficult social, ethical, legal issues that we're just beginning to get our hands on.
Lawyer and geneticist Professor Gary Marchant from the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. Before him, biomedical ethicist Dr. Emily Murphy and neuroanatomist Professor James Fallon. The combination of genetics and the latest generation of brain imaging techniques offers powerful new tools to detect differences between your head and mine. But could they also predict your behaviour or intentions, reveal when you're lying, and even, as is claimed, probe your innermost thoughts? It's an unsettling scenario, and at this early stage, an entirely unregulated domain, but it's already starting to be embraced by the legal system.
We've had over 100 cases involving brain scanning in the courts now. We've had over a dozen involving genetics and criminality, and I think it's only going to be more so in the future as these technologies, both the genetics and the brain scanning, become better developed and more validated in criminal and other kinds of cases in the future. Just like DNA evidence is now for forensic identification, we're going to start getting more and more of these cases in terms of trying to figure out what to do about the fact our brains are not all the same.
We're at the beginning of a revolution in our understanding of criminality, and increasingly, evidence is emerging that our genetics can influence antisocial or unhealthy behaviours. Professor James Fallon of the University of California at Irvine wanted to know if there was some way you could look at a young person's brain and tell if they were at a greater risk of becoming addicted to nicotine, even before they'd taken their first puff. So he fitted them out with a nicotine patch and used PET or positron emission tomography scans to look at how their brains responded to the nicotine while they did a standard computer test to measure their degree of hostility. Now, this makes sense since it's now understood that people with hostile personalities who easily get angry or impatient are more likely to become heavy smokers.
We had early on had done a study on the young sons of alcoholics who had never had a drink themselves. Their fathers were alcoholics. And you looked at the pattern of their brain activation using a PET scan, and looking at the genetics, you see that those with the same genetics, it already looks like the brains of their fathers. That is, the brains of the alcoholics before they've ever even had a drink. We did a completely separate study recently on smoking. And in this study, we looked at both smokers and non-smokers, people that never had a smoke at all. And the people who were non-smokers, who were highly hostile, had a certain brain pattern in the PET scan. Well, people who hadn't even smoked yet already had the brain patterns of somebody who probably is going to be a smoker, and in fact, people who are what we call genetic smokers, born to smoke. And so this tells you that the brain appears to be pre-wired to be more susceptible to addiction.
And it's not just tobacco, is it?
No. But if you look at all the addicts, there seems to be some very similar patterns. So you may have, in fact, somebody who was a smoker, they give up smoking, and then they become maybe a chocolate addict. They have a behavioral pattern of addiction. So these people seem to be wired a certain way, and it comes with a combination of traits. These people are risk takers and wanderlust. These are the same people that help spread humanity around the globe. These are the people that go over the mountain. These are the people that try things. The people that take chances. So during our evolution, many of these traits, which may be aggression and hostility, things that don't work so well now, probably had a lot to do with the fact that we are so successful as a species.
Professor James Fallon, who admits that in the nature versus nurture debate, he favours the primacy of organic and genetic causes for our behaviour. In one study, he was asked to examine brain scans from a group of 70 people that comprised psychopathic individuals convicted of murder, a control group, and people with schizophrenia, to see if there could be a way of telling them apart. It was quite a challenge. He was given absolutely no clues as to who the scans belonged to. It took months before Fallon detected a code. It was significant differences in metabolism and blood flow in part of the brain's prefrontal cortex and a subregion of that, the orbital cortex, just above the eyes, areas that are so key in moral reasoning and controlling emotions.
And so it turned out a very clean separation of these three, which really floored me because I had always thought there is no real way to determine if there's some pattern of brain anatomy or metabolism that has to do with being a killer.
You looked at 40 psychopaths and
that's right.
All had the same sort
of
differences.
They all had the same pattern, yeah. It was quite amazing.
So do you think that that is common, that all psychopaths have some difference in their brain anatomy that we can actually look at and detect?
We don't know that because we don't have that many that have been studied. There probably are a group that don't show anything obvious. And certainly there are those people who are nonviolent sociopaths, if you will, that don't show much difference from a normal-looking brain. That doesn't mean the subtleties, the combination of neurotransmitters, aren't enough to reduce functioning of the parts of the brain that affect ethical and moral reasoning and behavior. And so there may be something chronically wrong with these people, in fact, from very early on, but they're not so obvious to pick up. But I would suspect that all of them have something wrong with the prefrontal cortex.
And there is now a body of research reporting significant differences in other brain areas in psychopathic people. The earlier the problem arises, the more extreme the outcome.
So you can have this in utero genetic damage interacting with environment. But let's say a child gets hit by a car and they damage the prefrontal cortex and they're maybe 1 year old. In that case, these people have been found to grow up and they'll show this impulsive kind of behavior. They can have some of the syndrome of abusing animals, to be sexually abusive, really have a very deadened sense of stress. They don't get riled over anything. They kind of don't care. You can see this when they're 7, 8, 9 years old. This kind of early damage when somebody's 1 or 2, that seems to lead to somebody who does this stuff, but they don't know what they're doing is wrong. They don't have a sense of morality about it. This is different than somebody who has the damage, let's say 3, 4, or 5 years old. So after the prefrontal cortex starts to develop, that orbital cortex has been tuned up, if you will, then if the damage occurs, you may still have somebody who grows up as a teenager, who has conduct disorder, who appears sociopathic and then becomes violent and grows up to be a very dangerous person. Well, in these people, it's been found with this later damage to the brain, these people know what they're doing is wrong, but they can't stop the urge. And you see this in certain kinds of, let's say, criminals and violent people. Sometimes, hey, you know, he's kind of a nice guy, but he just can't control it. And it's even been found in some pedophiles. They could put it off for a year, two, or three. But ultimately, they feel compelled to do this awful stuff. And, you know, this has also been found with older men who have had tumors in the orbital cortex. They've been family guys with children. Everything's normal. They've never shown anything. All of a sudden, they start becoming pedophiles. Well, in a couple of these cases, it's been found that they had tumors of the orbital cortex. When the tumor was removed, all this pressure, they then went back to being fairly normal. So it shows you how, not just genetically, but organically, these brain structures control our sense of ethics, morality, and impulsive and compulsive behaviors.
Nevertheless, is there anything that society, or indeed parents, can do to prevent their children going down a bad path?
I would say that people are what they are very early on, and they develop at their own rate and with their own tastes and behavior, etc. And I think it's very, very hard to change that inherent makeup of a child as they're growing up.
Neuroscientist James Fallon on the contribution of our biology to our adult selves. So how do courts deal with the extreme cases where people blame their genes for their behavior, especially if they commit murder? Professor Gary Marchant.
And again, there's been a series of cases recently, most recently one here in Phoenix, the Jeff Landrigan case, where he was sentenced to be executed while on death row. He found out that he has a whole family history of violent crime. He was adopted at a very young age, didn't know about that history, but while on death row, a prison guard pointed out there's someone who looks almost identical to him, 20 years older, on death row in Arkansas. And based on some further research, they discovered that's his biological father, who hadn't seen him since he was 6 months old.
So what had this man done?
He had committed a series of crimes as a teenager, progressively becoming more and more violent until he finally committed a murder in Oklahoma and escaped from jail, fled to Arizona and committed another murder here, and that's the one he was sentenced to death for. And has tried to make the argument that he has a genetic predisposition to criminality or violence based on his family history. And this has been through the courts now here in the United States, and Court of Appeal initially held that the fact that he may have this genetic predisposition is all the more reason to execute him, not less, because he can't be cured.
What does all this say about free will and the court's regard to free will?
Well, you know, in our criminal law system, we have sort of this presumption of free will, and certainly almost everybody has some element of free will, but the amount of it is going to vary from individual to individual. You know, normal people don't commit some of these terrible crimes, something that an abnormal brain is required to do almost. It's sort of unfair to treat us all the same when we're not the same. On the other hand, if we do give people a free pass, just because of some abnormality, genetic or otherwise, won't we be basically denying them the free will that they still have some residue of, that they've chosen to ignore and to commit these terrible crimes? But given that they are at such greater risk, how do we take that into account? Should we give it any weight at all? And then do we start looking at kids before they commit the crimes who have those genes and start doing something with them before they've even committed the crime to try and avoid it?
Well, you know, sometimes the fix is worse than the disease. Who are we to tell who should procreate, who should be allowed to mix with society? I mean, that's a very dangerous thing. Do we live with certain X percent of violence and these sociopaths walking around? How much can we tolerate, you know? Because there's not a lot of those people. Most people are pretty normal. They'll get mad at things, but they cool off. Do you put the whole society at risk? You know, these are big questions I don't know the answer to.
And according to James Fallon, neither does the justice system.
My sense is, for juries, do they know enough science really to understand this? There's been such a culture of, well, the environment causes this, the environment, you're growing up, that it's very hard to shake that. And I don't think that the society can provide a system of law that can respond to this information now. It just takes a lot more understanding of the power of brain circuits, organically brain circuits, to change behavior.
Genetic arguments are still evolving and can be rather abstract, and judges and jurors, perhaps rightly, remain sceptical. But backed up with brain images purportedly revealing abnormalities, neuroscience is proving harder for the law to shrug aside. Professor Gary Marchant.
Turning first to brain scanning in the law, this is an area where we've identified now over 100 cases in the United States where brain scanning has been used, mostly criminal cases, but sometimes what are called tort or product liability cases. And so there's three main uses of them so far. One is when a criminal defendant basically is using brain scanning to show some abnormality in their brain to argue either they're not guilty by insanity or for some other reason don't have culpability, or to try and mitigate their sentence, to say my brain's not normal and somehow this should be taken into account to either let me off altogether or give me a reduced sentence. That's the main use. Another significant use is in tort injuries, where people get a closed brain injury, and these are very hard to verify in some kind of objective way, and there's a concern people are malingering or saying they're having some kind of symptoms. And so lawyers on both sides are using brain scanning to try and show that there is or is not a real change in the brain, a real injury in the brain as a result of a car accident or some other injury.
Scanning technology also has the potential to be used as a means of getting at whether or not you're telling the truth. Right now, it's a scientifically contentious area.
And then the third and most recent use is what is called brain fingerprinting, to try and use this technology to allegedly show whether or not a witness or a suspect in a case actually recognizes something, for example, from the crime scene by how their brain reacts and being able to monitor that with brain scanning. The big new one coming along is the idea of maybe using this as a lie detector. And there's a couple companies who are trying to commercialize using brain scanning to try and tell someone's telling the truth or not. And this would have just major repercussions for the legal system as well as society generally, because in court cases, for example, it's very common to have two witnesses saying exact opposite things. You know, he said, she said, a rape case or something where you really have only two people involved and one is probably lying. To be able to use brain scanning, if it can be used in this way to tell who's telling the truth, would be an enormous improvement to our legal system and be able to get fair decisions, but it obviously raises a lot of privacy and other types of issues.
Is there a danger that people might be compelled to undergo these tests?
Yeah, or certainly either mandatory that you do this, but also the negative implication if you don't undergo the test where other witnesses have, will that create a sort of an implication that you're somehow trying to hide something?
Is it really so much different than the polygraph test that we hear about so much?
Well, the polygraph test is notoriously very unreliable, and for that reason, courts in most states have refused to allow it to be admitted. So one of the big issues, will this be reliable enough to get over that hurdle and be used in court cases?
From what you've heard, do you think that it will?
I think it's only a matter of time.
Other countries have already ordered mandatory brain scanning of crime suspects.
Well, the Indian government seems to be, or prosecutors at least, seem to be very enamored with its brain fingerprinting technology that's been developed to determine whether someone has seen something from the crime scene before. So the Indian government and prosecutors have used this now in at least three recent cases, again, in an involuntary way without consent of the suspect, but being required to do so. And the most recent one was this case of a mass murder of children in one Indian province where over 20 different children were found to have been murdered and decapitated and dismembered, and two people living in a house, the owner of the house and a servant of him, were both initially believed to be suspects in the crime, and they were both taken into custody and subjected to both a truth serum and to this brain fingerprinting technology. And based on the results, the police at this point are going forward with charges only against one of the two, the servant, not the owner of the house.
And you're with All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, going global on Radio Australia and as podcast. This week, reporter Pauline Newman joins us from the courthouse in Phoenix, Arizona, host to a recent conference, The Law and Ethics of Brain Scanning, the Next Big Thing Coming to a Courthouse Near You.
The development of what's called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, has caught the attention of the legal system. It allows our brains to be scanned while we're challenged with certain questions or tasks. But is it all it's cracked up to be? Dr. Emily Murphy from the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics.
fMRI tells us the metabolic correlates of neural activity by measuring blood flow. And the images that come out, these brightly colored dots overlaid over structural pictures of brains, are indicators of a difference in blood oxygenation level between a behavioral task that we're interested in and a control task that subtracts out the aspects of the behavior that we're not interested in. So it just tells us what parts of the brain are having blood delivered to them when the subject performs that aspect of the task. It doesn't tell us what neurons are being activated. It doesn't even tell us what they're doing. There are a lot of methodological and very technical issues that limit what we should be able to interpret from fMRI. But it's non-invasive, it's highly regionally and temporally specific, and it's still expensive but getting cheaper, and people can actually look at neural correlates of behavior, which is a totally big advance over just structural imaging of the brain.
So tell me what sort of questions people are asked and what researchers might be looking for and what they see.
Ooh, people are looking for all kinds of things. People are interested in, as we heard a lot about today, in lie detection. It might be done at airports, it might be done in employment screenings, it might be done in sexual assault cases. We don't know.
So you think it might be used in the employment arena?
There is definitely that possibility. That is one of the stated goals of one of the companies who are marketing these technologies. Why not? That's what employers are looking for. If they can predict behavior, predict aptitude, correlate it with a personality screening, and there have been studies that show visualization of cocaine craving, things like drug abuse. If someone can pass a urine test but is, in fact, addicted to cocaine, what does that mean for how they should be employed? And when the employer or third party conducts these scans, who gets to evaluate them and on what premises?
What would you say is the promise of this technology?
The promise is considerable. If we can predict disease that we are able to treat before the onset of mental illness, that's going to be phenomenal. The promise of the technology in commercial applications is also potentially very huge. We did see some interesting evidence today, and it's coming out in the peer literature about lie detection, deception detection, truth verification. There's a lot of open doors there that this technology could step through and then fill.
And let's not forget that it's not just that there are existing insurance companies, institutions out there who might want to use this, but the companies that make these technologies are going to be out there actively selling and actively promoting a wide range of different uses, that we need to ask hard questions about whether or not those are legitimate uses of these kinds of technologies.
Associate Professor Clark Miller with the Consortium for Science, Policy and Outcomes at Arizona State University, sounding a note of caution. He's concerned that fMRI technology in particular is being vastly oversold. Results are inconsistent, with different research groups failing to replicate each other's work. Another serious objection is that large-scale trials looking at varying populations are few and far between. In fact, it's one of the commercial fMRI companies that's taking the lead here. These issues are crucial for valid science, but are they lost on the wider public when we read headlines like, "Brain scans help fight against terrorism"?
And I think it's that sort of tacit acceptance that raises some concerns for me, at least, because a sense of history suggests that there will be times when these kinds of technologies are abused, and that we can become overly accepting of technologies that actually do create security, but that also create side effects.
Clark Miller. Back in the courtroom, if a brain scan could reveal or validate the content of an eyewitness memory, the fact remains memories don't necessarily point to the truth. In an experiment at the University of Arizona, Professor John Allen got people to learn a list of words and then lie about having learned half of them. By measuring the brain's electrical activity, he could detect when they were telling the truth or lying about 94% of the time. However,
what if somebody thinks that they have remembered something that in fact didn't happen? So we used a laboratory manipulation to create a false memory. This is the kind of thing, if I give you a list of words, like illness, hospital, nurse, physician, sick, somewhere along the way down the road, you might falsely recall that I said the word doctor, even though that I didn't. And now we use the same brainwave procedure, and we look at their brain activity to items that were actually on the list. It's brain activity that suggests these words are familiar. Words they never heard give brain activity that looks like they're not familiar. And then the key question is, what about these words, the words like doctor, that were never on the list but people falsely remember? Turns out that those words are indistinguishable from words that were actually on the list.
So what does that say about people's brains when they actually claim that a particular event has happened when objective evidence might suggest it hasn't?
Right. Well, assuming we can rule out they're malingering or they're making it up, it suggests that the brain encodes events from lots of different sources, from veridical activities, from our imagination, from things we read, and lots of things get pulled together in a way to construct a memory, to construct a story. And people actually believe it, and it probably depends on much of the same circuitry.
This conference is about brain scanning and its use for lawmakers and judges. Now, in the light of your experiments, do you think brain scanning can be of use?
I think there may be limited cases in which it can. But I do think that the data that we have showing that false memories and true memories are hard to differentiate, and it's not just with our brain electrical activity, but there are other groups that have done work with functional magnetic resonance imaging that show the same thing, that ultimately is going to leave open the possibility then that, you know, no matter how compelling the picture looks and, you know, no matter how sensitive it is to true memories, it leaves open the possibility that false memories could also produce that pattern of data, and that is going to limit the utility.
But one of the more chilling uses of brain scans could be outside the courts and even before people have committed a crime. When it comes to protecting vulnerable populations like children from possible perpetrators, can we ever dare take chances? Emily Murphy.
I think that research in that area, if it continues to be pushed forward, might be one particular area where that's really taken up in the public. Anybody who works with children, even in a volunteer capacity in hospital, are screened for any sort of strange behavior, but particularly criminal backgrounds. And the screening is very intense. It's not necessarily a big step then to add a scan in.
But a scan would be predictive, and someone might not have ever done anything wrong in their lives.
That's entirely true, and that's going to be a very difficult issue to deal with.
But then the possibility arises of maybe changing people's brains if we know that
Absolutely.
They have tendencies.
Absolutely. There are technologies and drugs out there that are already able to do that. The forced use of those technologies is something that we haven't yet encountered, to my knowledge, but is definitely on the agenda.
Horrifying as that scenario sounds, could the tools and techniques of neuroscience prevent crimes before they occur? Could it make our streets safer? And even empty the jails. Gary Marchant.
That's one thing these kind of technologies could lead to, maybe a more happy outcome, is basically to change our criminal system from being a legal and a punishment system to more of a medical system. If we can either treat people who have committed crimes or even better, anticipate people who have these problems and treat them ahead of time to avoid these terrible tragedies for primarily the victims, but also the people who commit them, that would be a really positive result. But it, of course, raises all kinds of difficult issues of privacy and free will and free choice if we're going to start intervening before people commit crimes. And that raises a lot of sort of science fiction scenarios that may not be that far away.
It's wonderful that we're thinking about all these things now, and the technology advances are going to be phenomenal.
Well, I think we haven't seen anything yet. We're at the beginning of a substantial transformation in our understanding of the human brain and also our ability to actually intervene in how the brain works. So we have seen in the last decade widespread investments on the part of governments in neuroscience, but those investments continue to grow. And so I suspect in the near future we're going to see increasingly precise resolution of these brain scanning technologies, increasing insights through these brain scanning technologies and their successors into what is actually happening in the brain and how that connects to what we're actually thinking at any particular moment in time, and how that is connected to our own notions of mind and self and identity. And it's going to change a lot.
Pauline Newman with that report on neuroscience and the law, a minefield. We'll follow the developments with an eagle eye. More info along with the audio podcast and later in the week the transcript on our website at abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. Thanks this week to producer Kyla Brettle. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and next week more spooky mind reading. Bye for now.
you've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.